welcome to the House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell, and I am delighted today to be joined by Right Honourable Angela Eagle MP. Hello,
hi.
Angela.
Hi.
So, Angela, you have written with
Imran
Ahmed,
yep.
A new book called The New Serfdom.
Yeah.
So, first questions first. Why this book? Why now?
Well, I think that when you come off the front bench, you have a little bit more time to contemplate, because modern politics is very, very sort of immediate, with constant things coming past you daily. And I thought it was a good time to just step back from that daily sort of battle and take a more strategic look at where we were in politics in general on the left. And so this book is really an attempt to bring out into the open the ideology of conservatism, which has landed us in the place we're in at the moment, which I think, by the way, is in a society that's increasingly unequal, that's increasingly socially, environmentally and economically unsustainable. And it's that because of the features of the belief system that Friedrich Hayek, who's the Austrian economist that we talk about in the book, his ideology creates this kind of very individualistic, unequal society. And for those who don't remember Mrs. Thatcher, it's really his, Friedrich Hayek's extreme version of capitalism, if you want to call it that. I call it market fundamentalism in the book, which has delivered over the last 40-odd years the system that we've got now, and the results that we've got now. And so it's really an attempt to bring out into the open the ideological underpinnings, which have become so much part of the furniture and politics that people have forgotten to that they exist. And so it's really about sort of saying, we could actually do things differently and get a different result, but let's look at what's causing us to be where we are now.
I mean, you quite helpfully, because I don't think many people have actually read Hayek, but you sort of...
it's quite dense when you read it.
It is, and you know, obviously this is someone who died a good few years ago, and Margaret Thatcher is long gone now, although her ideas stubbornly persist through the current government. But you very much sort of outline in a nice simplistic way the sort of three big lies on which
yep.
the market fundamentalism is based on.
Yep.
That the only way to have freedom is to have completely free markets, unfettered markets.
Well, that they actually, it's even worse than that, it's that they actually, the way that the market collects information through the price mechanism is the only viable way of coming to a collective decision about anything that doesn't sacrifice individual freedom, which is ludicrous. But anyway, that's a very important principle of what Friedrich Hayek believed.
And that individualism, and not just individualism, but selfishness and greed are seen as these principal guiding...
Well, the market
principles.
Doesn't work unless you indulge in what they call, enlightened individualism, greed, really.
Yeah.
And in that way, they actually turn what is one of the seven deadly sins into a virtue.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, that because you can't have that as a virtue without also believing that inequality is in itself a good, that inequality is what drives competition and is what drives progress.
And the paradox of the market mechanism that taken to this extreme, this fundamentalist extreme, is that you end up saying if you're poor, you need to be incentivized to work even harder by having your wages cut. But if you're rich, you need to be incentivized by being given more reward for the work that you do, which even in itself, that proposition ought to be seen for the self-interested...
And not even for the work
rubbish
that, you
do. That it is.
I mean, if we look at the way that they protect inheritance, it's for the work that maybe somebody in your family did several generations before.
Or centuries ago.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very reactionary economic belief system, and it is a faith, which is why I call it market fundamentalism, because it's been disproved. A lot of what it asserts as truth is faith-based belief, actually, and it's been disproved again and again and again by experience, but it doesn't shake the belief of the people that believe that markets ought to be spread into everything and that the price mechanism is the only viable way of making a choice. What they don't say is that if you don't have money and you can't actually make your demand real because you don't have spending power, your choices through a price mechanism aren't taken into account in the market. So it's a very, very exclusive and particular way of looking at things, which by its own definitions leads to a solution where those who are already privileged and well off remain privileged and well off. And when you read The Road to Serfdom, which is Friedrich Hayek's book where he set out these changes, which were published at the height of the Labour government and the battle against Hitler, where collectivism was very important, he basically said, well, if you do things in this collective where you compromise freedom, individual freedom, and therefore you're on the road to serfdom. What this book tries to point out and show is that 40 years of putting that kind of faith-based market fundamentalism into practice in both America and our own country has actually led to what we've called a new serfdom. And to look at what that means, you just need to look at some of what's going on in the gig economy at the moment, the kind of separation of our labour market into what are known as lousy and lovely jobs, and that kind of hourglass labour market where you have a lot of lousy jobs at the bottom, some great jobs at the top, and everyone else is slipping from the middle down to the bottom.
I mean, I think for me, the fundamental lie at the heart of Hayek's proposition is that we are all better off if we are as untouched by the state as possible.
Yep.
And that's only true for those people whose assets may be redistributed. But for the vast majority of us, we rely on the state services every day, whether that's in health, education, just walking down a non-broken pavement.
I don't think that he really... in his ideas have been taken even further to extreme after he sort of died. And some of the things that are asserted routinely now, probably he might have argued with.
He might have brought
although he was a pretty reactionary man who admired Pinochet and loved Mrs. Thatcher and hated trade unions because they were an expression of collective power. So I don't think that we should be too generous towards him. But he basically was from sort of Austrian bourgeoisie, very well off, grew up in that kind of milieu, in an Austria where the state wasn't that present, and he didn't like the encroachment of the state, particularly the welfare systems that happened after the war. But of course, to me and to many people in the Labour Party, creating a state like that, which is enabling, and creating a social security system and the health service, actually is a definition of civilization. It was the time when people realized that if they pulled together and the state actually provided things collectively, then it led to a fairer outcome, and it actually meant that people didn't have to worry about not being able to pay doctors' fees. They could have access to healthcare if they needed it, rather than dying prematurely because they couldn't afford it. They could have access to a kind of collective insurance system if they fell on hard times. Now, I think after the depredations of the last 8 years of austerity and the state of our social security system now, we do need to rebuild those ideas of collectivism in order that we can realise we can create a better society if we all support each other rather than just depend on our own individual sort of approach and think that somehow human beings are all living an existence independent of each other, when actually we're social beings and we get on much better and we're much happier when we work together as in wider society and as a community.
And you make a lovely analogy between the development of socialism and evolution and the way that we have evolved to be exactly those kind of social cooperative creatures.
Well, we are social beings. We couldn't not be and have our infants take so long to develop until they're independent. I mean, if you look in nature, some creatures are up on their feet in 5 seconds because they die otherwise, whereas human beings nurture children and infants for far longer in a very vulnerable state. So that means we've developed as a species cooperating with each other and making a better life for our communities as a whole, because we cooperate, because we've got into a slightly more sophisticated context. That doesn't mean to say those basics have gone away.
No, absolutely. And I think there's definitely, I think, in society at the moment, a sense that something is lacking, that the system in some way has gone wrong.
Yeah.
I think there's a great hunger. You actually make the quite bold prediction in your book that market fundamentalism is dying.
Well, it doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
And it's led us to some of the crises that we've seen. I think both environmental crises, which were as we swelter through our very hot summer, we're seeing and beginning to realise that we're in the middle of a big mass extinction of animals and plants in our globe, and those aren't coming back if we don't do something to mitigate the effect we have on our global ecosystems, but also socially and really economically. The system's gone too far in a particular direction. Using an economic system, classical economic system, which is not really representative of reality and has become so fixated on what's known as the economic man, it doesn't represent a model that gives us proper predictions anymore, and in fact it causes active damage.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And this book is a really extensive diagnosis of the problem, both in the UK. I mean, largely focused on
it is
UK
largely focused on
but
the
there
UK,
is also
but
some global sort of aspects.
We've
to
thrown
that.
A few in.
There is a lot of excitement about what might replace capitalism at the moment, and you go through some of the predictive models to a more or less extent. I think you're about as dismissive of blue labour as I am. But you come back time and again to democratic
yes.
socialism.
Yeah.
Why is it that you feel that is the model that should be the replacement?
Well, look, I think that the form of market fundamentalist capitalism we've got at the moment is driving change that isn't sustainable. But it is possible, as I've always thought as a democratic socialist, to harness some of the dynamism there and set it in a proper context. And I think some of the new economics demonstrates a willingness to say, well, actually, economics isn't the be-all and the end-all of all social sciences. It actually ought to be regarded as part of a wider, more holistic system, be it our planet and its ecosystems or the universe or whatever. But it's the whole thing isn't driven simply by economic ideas. There's a load of other things that people want to prioritise, such as environmental sustainability, social sustainability. Perhaps they don't want to live in a sort of Hobbesian dog-eat-dog world where life is nasty, brutish and short. Perhaps they want to say, well, let's mitigate some of the ways that markets work in our health service, so we don't have markets in our health service, and we say some things are more important than what you can afford to pay for them or being delivered by the market, because we know the flaws of the market. And I think when you look at democratic socialism, five timeless values, really, equality, democracy, liberty, cooperation and internationalism, those are the things we need to deal with some of the major problems the globe is facing now. And I think if you think about what democratic socialism is, and the kind of values that it wants to see embedded in any kind of society, those five things sum it up enough for me. I may have left something out, I don't know. But if you think about cooperation, competition has its place. We're all in the middle of watching the World Cup, and that's fine. But we don't have to compete constantly for everything. We're not in a dog-eat-dog world. We can create more values sometimes by cooperating. Clearly, if we're going to deal with the issues of climate change, if we're going to deal with the issues of migration or terrorism, we have to cooperate internationally. The Conservative Party has a problem with that, which is why we're in the middle of all this Brexit stuff. And we are in an era increasingly where right-wing populism is ascendant. But actually, again, the only antidote to that is actually the democratic socialist values. You either have that vision of society or you have a right-wing angry populism, which we're seeing growing, which divides people rather than brings them together, which is the politics of blame and bigotry and resentment rather than the politics of hope and cooperation. Now, because we've stopped talking about democratic socialism for years and years and years, and the Labour Party's never been very good at talking about the theory of this, what we've got at the moment is a choice between right-wing, angry, Trump-style populism and conservatism. And what I'm saying is actually we ought to be talking about democratic socialism, which is harnessing markets, reforming capitalism in a way that makes it, puts it in its proper place. So you use markets, you use market mechanisms where they're appropriate, but where they're not appropriate, you come to your decisions in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, it's always struck me that markets are an amoral force. They don't have a
totally morality, amoral,
but they can have moral and immoral
natural
ends.
They're not natural either. Yeah. I mean, Friedrich Hayek and his market fundamentalists say that somehow market forces are natural, but actually markets are socially embedded in the society that creates them, which is why you see different forms of capitalism in different cultures. There's nothing natural about it. So you can harness these forces and the ways that people trade using money and the price mechanism works, but you don't let them get out of kilter or get out of hand, or you end up with the absurdity which we're in now, where, as Thomas Piketty points out in his book Capital, because the wealth is now creating bigger returns because of the way it can invest and get returns on the money that's invested, than economic growth, that means mathematically that the people who are already rich are going to get richer and richer and richer, and wealth will concentrate and concentrate and concentrate in smaller numbers of people's hands, and we're seeing this. And that is not a viable system. You have to do something about that, or you end up with an oligopoly, a global oligopoly of a few stunningly rich people, and the rest of us are all, you know, serfs.
Yeah, it's as I say, it's imposing moral order on an amoral system to avoid immoral ends.
Yeah, that's a reasonable definition. I wish I'd have thought of that.
Hi, I'm Emma Burnell, a political journalist.
Hi, I'm Steve Fielding. I'm Professor of Political History at the University of Nottingham.
And together, we do a monthly podcast called The Zeitgeist Tapes,
during which we talk about a film, TV show, anything to do with culture and its political implications.
We hope you'll enjoy it. Please do look for us on iTunes as The Zeitgeist Tapes. And if you do enjoy it, don't forget to rate and review.
You're quite hard on the third way in this, and not just the third way, but the sort of the lack of confidence that the left has had since the 70s, really, in pursuing and fighting for and arguing for and making an argument for democratic socialism, and also in the timidity of the state as a mechanism, civil servants as the people who are there to do it. Would you say that confidence is the core value that's missing?
Well, certainly. The Labour Party hasn't really done enough work in this area, and we have various things going on in the further to the left, and a lot of that tends to be quite utopian and not really very practical. And I'm a practical politician. I wrote this book with Imran as a practical politician in a way to try to communicate some of these quite dense ideas, but I hope in a way that people will understand. I think that the Labour Party must now renew its arguments for the creation of a society based on those democratic socialist values I talked about. Not an extreme utopian view, and I mention accelerationism and post-capitalism in the book, but actually that kind of pragmatic, well, I think we could do better than this. We know that capitalism can be very dynamic, but we also know that it can be amoral and it can lead to great inequalities of wealth which aren't sustainable. And that's the position we're getting to now. So what can we do better? And how can we express a more collective view? Well, the Labour Party should have been doing that. But when we had the big landslide in 1997, the difficulty was that the third way was really essentially pessimistic about how we might change the economic hegemony, if you want to put it that way. And it basically said, look, globalization's happened, nothing can be done about it, therefore we have to think about how we redistribute the rewards from the economy we've got. Now, if the Attlee government had have said that, we would never have created the health service. So it was essentially saying we can only do stuff after the wealth and the income has been created. And I think I objected to that at the time. I thought it was overly defensive. And certainly after three terms of office, one would have hoped you'd be able to change the political terms of trade more fundamentally than we did. And we didn't do that because essentially New Labour was too pessimistic about what might have been achieved. So it accommodated to the existing market fundamentalist system. It did fantastic work in redistributing, in creating a lot more opportunities for people, in refinancing the health service and all those things. But in the end, first Osborne budget, slash and burn our budget, and you've lost the Sure Start centres. You've lost a lot of the things that we were happy about in terms of refinancing the health service. And you've not been able to create, apart from the minimum wage, institutions that are collective, labour institutions, which project our values into forward into the future. And that's my objection to New Labour. I understand why it came about, but I think it was an enormous wasted opportunity.
And of course, the fragility when you don't change the system has exactly been demonstrated by all those things it was so easy to lose.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, market fundamentalism has created a down escalator for our Labour people, that we have to run up to try and make things more equal. And we did make things more equal, apart from the top 1%. But the top 1% actually matters quite a lot. I mean, absolutely it matters. And so if, in order to make things more equal, you have to run up a down escalator, and you have a government that suddenly stops you being able to run, you just go down. And so you've not changed the terms of trade enough.
This is my own personal interest, but you talk a lot about the enabling state.
Yep.
It's very much the nation state, sort of centred on national government, and then some supranational areas. Like,
well, I think actually we need more supranational areas. That's the irony of Brexit and all of those things, particularly, for example, in order to crack down on the huge evasion and avoidance of tax payments that are going on, the behaviour of the global multinational companies who basically arbitrage where they put their headquarters so they can avoid paying tax in particular countries. We cannot allow that kind of system to be superimposed on national governments. So we have to have actually more international cooperation to crack down on that than we've got now, not less.
I mean, I agree with all of that. There is a question about subsidiarity, I suppose, which is, I'm very much kind of, I come from a local government perspective.
Yeah.
So where is the local state in this vision, and how does that sort of work within this?
Well, I think we're seeing what happens when the local state disappears because of the cuts. And it means that a lot of the laws that we pass here aren't enforceable because you can't enforce them locally. So I worry about weights and measures. The sort of presence of horse meat in the human food chain in Britain was noticed in Ireland. It wasn't noticed over here. You can't ensure that you're inspecting schools properly. You can't run the local road systems. So, yes, I think that we need a renaissance of accountable local government and regional government as well in order to enforce the rules we have. I think one of the big issues now is that the laws that Parliament passes aren't always, increasingly, actually, they're not enforced.
So, as you said, you're a practical, pragmatic person. So what, when everyone in the Labour Party has read the book...
Yeah, well, coming along.
What are the next steps that you'd like them to take?
Well, I think that we need to start talking about what our values as a society and as a party are. And I think those five values I mentioned earlier, we must always look to increase, not decrease, equality. We must be democratic and give people real choices. We have to really focus on individual liberty as well and recognise that liberty involves being able to have choices that you can make as an individual, not be someone who's stuck in dead-end work without being able to make any choice, or somebody who's sanctioned by the benefit system and not have your own individual autonomy. I think that's quite an important and neglected part of democratic socialism. We have to cooperate with each other and create vibrant communities rather than solipsistic, individual, selfish households. And we also, if we're going to survive as a planet, we need much more international cooperation to tackle these supranational problems, which are existential, some of them. I think if we could start talking about our appeal for the 21st century, certainly the 2020s, in those terms, we'd be able to communicate a lot more. The book deals with the rise of the Fourth Industrial Revolution and artificial intelligence, all of those things, which are going to transform the way that our lives are lived, are already, as we know from social media, the rise of Facebook and the big tech giants, beginning to compromise our democracy. And we need to base what we're doing on a respect for the truth and not fake news and propaganda. We need to ensure that a lot of these tech companies stop behaving in ways that are just turbocharging propaganda and advertising. And we need to make certain that we respect facts, which is why I talk about Enlightenment 2.0 in the book, so that we can have systems that enable truth-telling rather than lie-telling. And we're at the very beginning of a process with respect to that, which I think will change politics.
And where do you see your role in that?
Oh, I was grateful to be able to step back and do a little bit of thinking about some of this. I'm a democratic socialist, not a communist. I believe that democracy and having a democratic system which isn't subverted by powerful interests is really important, because I believe in the general good sense of collective decision-making, even if I don't agree with some of the election results we've had. And I think that as a practicing democratic politician, you always have to listen to what the electorate is telling you seriously. And you have to set out some of the big issues and problems that will be facing us soon. And there are very, very many that will challenge our ability to operate as a society. I think the Fourth Industrial Revolution is going to be as disruptive as the first. And the Labour Party was created as part of a reaction to what happened in the First Industrial Revolution. And we need to recreate our appeal and our capacity to protect people through the massive change that's going to go on in the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Otherwise, we don't deserve to survive.
I mean, you describe the Labour Party quite visually as a symptom of the First Industrial Revolution.
Almost, yeah. I mean, it was definitely the creation, the reaction of working class people was to create institutions that helped protect their interests. And obviously the burgeoning trade union movement came before the Labour Party, and in fact tried in many different ways to get political representation before the decision was taken to seek direct working class representation in Parliament, which we all know about from our history books. And if that hadn't been done, it would have to be done now, in my view. And so it's really important that we take our cue from the needs and requirements of those who don't have a voice in the system now.
Just to sort of step back from the book a little bit, it's obviously been a turbulent few years for the Labour Party, and
for everybody. I think the whole of politics is turbulent at the moment, and we are going through a transition. There's no doubt about that, from one era to another. And the economic collapse that happened in 2008 is still working its way through, and we are in a situation where our current economic system does not provide a reasonable sort of standard of living for the vast majority of people. And if we don't change that, then people will start listening to authoritarian voices who promise to change it.
As a journalist, it would be remiss of me not to ask you about the 2016 leadership contest, which you weren't a candidate in, but were... You launched a bid and then withdrew.
Yeah.
You obviously felt that you had what it took to take on Jeremy Corbyn at that point and lead the Labour Party in a different direction. And obviously Owen Smith only managed to get 38% of the vote. So the obvious question is, would you have done better?
I don't know. I mean, parallel universes. I mean, naturally I thought I had things to offer. I wouldn't have put myself forward. I think if you look at what happened at that time, the shock of the referendum result was massive, and there was a collective sort of breakdown in both political parties. And I think both major political parties in this country, paradoxically, though they got the biggest vote between them in the 2017 election as the other UKIP and the other fringe parties fell away, by fringe I mean the Liberal Democrats, I still think there are enormous stresses and pressures on both major political parties in this country. You can see it in here in the Conservative Party. I think we're more settled in the Labour Party at the moment. But I think if the parties don't evolve to start talking about the issues that people are facing day in, day out, of insecurity, of rising inequality, of feeling that the system is not delivering even basic standards to people. People who are young now can't expect to do better than their parents, can't expect to get a house, but they can order Nike trainers of whatever colour they want. You know, capitalism is extremely good at providing the nice-to-have stuff like trainers, and it's increasingly bad and awful at providing necessities like
housing.
And we know health, which is why we created the health service. So I just think we need to sort of reset the way that our society is going to banish market fundamentalism and come to a view that's different and do better with the wealth and money that our economy generates. And, I mean, I think that when I stood... it sounds like a funny thing that for me to get to that stage... from a leadership bid, but I think the referendum was like the beginnings of the moving of a huge kaleidoscope, and it's still moving, and I'm not quite sure where the pieces are going to end up, but this is an attempt to say, whilst everything's moving, can we actually get back to some basic political and economic philosophy and start talking about our values and why we're here and what sort of a society we want to create.
So my final question, you were talking about parallel universes just now. The two heroines you mentioned in the book are Sarah Connor from The Terminator and Ripley from the Alien movies. So who knew you were such a sci-fi nut? And what are you currently watching?
Well, I mean, I've been watching The Bridge, it has to be said. I've liked The Bridge. I've always been a movie fan, and so I love movies. I don't get to see them as much as possible, but I like empowered women who take responsibility. And in fact, when I talk about Enlightenment 2.0, recreating some of the ideology around the Enlightenment, which is universal human rights, including women, and
something
having
that
a more
sometimes it's left out
exactly, and having well, it was left out in the French Assembly,
yeah.
which is what kicked off Mary Wollstonecraft, and she was right. But it's important that we get back to some of those basics about including people, valuing them as human beings, allowing them their democratic say, and including everybody's views, or we will end up in a society that's imprisoned certain people in dead-end jobs with no ambition, and we won't have a liberated society. So I think some of the answer to market fundamentalism is more liberation for more people, and obviously that includes the 51% of our population that are women. We've made big strides, but we've still got a long way to go in all of these areas, and the more we can concentrate on things like that, the more we will get different values coming to the forefront, and we won't have this obsession with economic man or Trump-style populists or strongmen or this peculiar view of leadership that we have, which has got to be imposing stuff on everybody. I think Jeremy actually represents some of that, he represents a sort of longing to get away from that view where somehow politics is a kind of thing you do every now and again with an election, but nothing really changes because you've outsourced all your... You've taken the politics out of politics, and however you vote, nothing changes. That's obviously got to end. We've got to have a better view of how economics works that's more realistic and more liberating for more people. And we've got to recognise that politics isn't a zero-sum game. If you can lift all the boats rather than have just a few people dominate, that's a better solution, and it's a more effective solution. So I hope some of those ideas will get across in the debates that we have to have about what's going to be concerning us in the near future.
Angela, thank you very much. It just leaves me to say a big thank you to Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune, and this has been a Political Human Production.